Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan, and this is the Conversations Politics podcast. The Paris attacks have put the fight against Islamic State and issues of protection against terrorism at home front and centre. Malcolm Turnbull, who's on his first major overseas trip as Prime Minister, has had discussions with the American President, the Russian President, and many other leaders about the aftermath of these events in Paris. Today, I'm joined by Peter Jennings, who's Executive Director of the Australian Strategic Policy Institute, a think tank in Canberra which specialises in national security and defence issues. Peter Jennings, the coalition and Russia appear to be moving towards coordinating their military efforts against Islamic State. Do you think this can work, and will Russia prove to be a cooperative partner in the push?
Michelle, I doubt very much that Russia will prove to be a cooperative partner. I don't have a lot of confidence in Vladimir Putin's goodwill here in terms of dealing with the West. I think his primary interest in Syria is about supporting the Assad regime, perhaps not so much Bashar al-Assad himself, but the regime and Russian interests in Syria. Now, to the extent that that coincides with an interest that both Russia and the international coalition has to go after the Islamic State, you know, we may have a sort of temporary friendship between these Putin and Obama in the West. But generally speaking, the Russians are not to be trusted. And it seems to me that their interests are really more about propping up the Alawite regime than it is going after IS in any serious-minded way.
How would such coordination actually work in practice? What would be the military staples holding it together?
There wouldn't be much more to it than simply providing notification of aircraft movements, and that would be ringing up a headquarters to say we will be flying through a squadron of Russian aircraft or the other way around. In fact, what's interesting is that the Russians and the international coalition have very different ways of fighting these conflicts. The Russians drop unguided weapons, they're dropping cluster munitions, they're more than happy to take large numbers of civilian casualties. The West, on the other hand, is using precision weapons, and most of the time not actually dropping bombs. They're a bit out of concern not to injure innocent civilians. So, you know, aligning how these two things work, I think, is really very, very difficult indeed. And there won't be much more to this coordination than just making sure they're not going to fly into each other at any one point in the day.
The Russians, it's been said, have been attacking opposition groups in Syria, not just IS. Do you think that that's just been inefficiency, or has that been deliberate?
Oh, that's quite deliberate. Mostly, I'd say about 85-90% of Russian strikes have been against the Free Syrian Army, which is actually the group that is most directly taking the fight to the Assad forces. The Islamic State has kind of kept out of this because what they're really doing is just trying to consolidate their own territory. And they'll go and attack the Kurds if they want to do that to create space for themselves. They'll move down to Palmyra and kill Sunnis. But they've actually done their best to stay out of Assad's way. So really, the Russians' interest in attacking the Islamic State has only been as a sort of a political cover for their broader political objectives. Now, that may change in one sense, which is that the Russians, now having admitted that it was an IS bomb that brought down the aircraft, out of a sense of sort of punitiveness, may actually be more interested to go after IS than they were up until just a few days ago.
Now, there were peace talks in Vienna at the weekend looking for a path to some sort of settlement in Syria. Do you think that a ceasefire followed by eventual elections will be achievable, or is this really pie in the sky?
Well, I must say I was very surprised at the extent to which a plan for at least a pathway to a peace process was discussed in Vienna. The major impediment to this working in any way at all, however, is the Islamic State, because they will not be a party to any peace process. no side is prepared to engage with them.
But isn't the whole idea of a peace process that you get the Assad government and the opposition groups in Syria together, and then collectively you put more pressure on the Islamic State?
I think it's going to be very difficult to achieve that. My sense is that what's actually happening under the guise of this process now is a consolidation of sort of de facto boundaries inside Syria, with Assad and the Alawites essentially occupying the coastal strip and some mountainous land on the territory on the border with Lebanon, the Kurds in the north, and the sort of Sunni badlands in the centre, which is comprised not only of IS, but the Free Syrian Army and a whole range of other groups who are have different strategic objectives. Now, in practice, I think it's going to be too hard for those Sunni groups to align themselves or to sort of reconcile themselves with Assad's people to actually make a success of the process. And therefore, I think there is a question of getting the sequence right here, which is first IS, then the peace process, rather than the other way around.
Now, Australia was excluded from these talks. Apparently, the Russians essentially didn't want Australia there. What do you make of this? What do you think the reason is?
Well, to be honest, I don't know that we've got that much to usefully bring to the table other than to sort of exhort all the parties to be reasonable and get on with each other.
On the other hand, we make a very major contribution, the second to the US, to the coalition, and also everyone else seemed to be there. There were some 20 countries and organisations present.
Well, it may be that we're paying a price for some shirt fronting that took place a few months ago. I mean, I would have thought Australia does have an honest broker role to play. And it was interesting to see also Malcolm Turnbull, you know, hinting at the possibility of Australian involvement in monitoring a peace process some way down the track. So, you know, it kind of reflects our position as being, you know, not very strong on the ground in the Middle East in terms of a willingness of parties to listen to us, even though we are making a reasonably solid military commitment.
President Obama has this week ruled out boots on the ground, sending in combat troops, perhaps to the relief of Malcolm Turnbull, who wouldn't particularly want an American request at this stage. Yes. And yet some experts say that combat troops really is the only way of making progress in this conflict. What's your view?
Well, combat troops is the only way of making progress. That's certainly the case, to consolidate gains that might be helped by airstrikes. But I think it's also true that Obama is not going to return. And, you know, the one thing his strategy is crystal clear on is there's no return to the large numbers of American forces we saw a decade ago. However, Obama's strategies are sort of subtly changing, even if his rhetoric isn't. And what that goes to is we are seeing more American special forces being committed, even in small numbers, but they're there now assisting the Kurds in northern Syria. And a week or so ago, we saw a US special forces operation to free some hostages. So I think we may see more of that. And probably Malcolm Turnbull shouldn't get too relaxed too soon, because that could in time lead to a request for more assistance on the special forces front.
And what do you think will happen after the Obama administration? Because after all, that has, a year and some months to run only.
Yes. So about 14 or 15 months to run. But then you need to add onto that, Michelle, perhaps, you know, half a year for key members of the next administration to get congressional authorization for their positions. So we're really facing a period of, I think, 18 months, mostly of drift out of Washington. And then, you know, the issue will be, who will the president be? If it's Hillary Clinton, I think we'll have a return to a more engaged Democrat style of engagement with the world, and that Clinton might be prepared to countenance, you know, increases in the small thousands of American troops. And I think in the case of the Republicans, it's anyone's guess, really. I mean, we're unlikely to have an isolationist on the Republican side. And so therefore, I think probably in every respect, Obama reflects the most tentative and inward-looking that we're going to see out of the American presidency, and that the next president, whoever that is, will be more engaged and more inclined to do something.
So this could see an escalation of conflict in the Middle East, you're saying?
Well, the situation won't stay static until we get to that point, though. And I think, if we have a period of 18 months of stalemate, then at the end of it, the Islamic State will be stronger, will be that much closer to the reality of Iraq and Syria really having split up and never likely to be brought back together again. I also can't see Bashar al-Assad staying in power for that length of time. I suspect that the Russians may at some stage cut him loose if they think that will help their own agenda. And there, you know, the issue that Putin faces is that he's engaged in a bit of a gamble. I mean, he faces the same problem now of being drawn into a war that's impossible to find a solution to that the Americans faced in Iraq a decade ago. So how the Russians deal with that, I think, is probably going to bring about some quite fast changes to the shape of Syria in particular over the next 18 months, you know, well before the presidential election.
Just as a side point, it's interesting to contemplate, isn't it, how things would have gone if it had been Tony Abbott meeting the president this week, because Tony Abbott has written in the last day or so that, in fact, the fight should be escalated, that you need more forces. Mm-hmm. So I wonder how that conversation would have gone.
Well, I think Abbott arrived at a view pretty early on that, you know, what Australia needed to do was to try and urge the United States to be more engaged in this conflict. And that was why we saw such an early Australian involvement and, by our scale, a large Australian involvement. And if that was Abbott's objective, it didn't succeed. Obama was, you know, absolutely refusing to move off the line that it would only be about 3,500 American troops, which is, by the way, less than half the number of troops the Americans sent to West Africa to deal with the Ebola crisis. It's actually a very small contribution that the Americans have made. So I don't know that it would have been necessarily such a happy meeting if it had been Mr. Abbott talking to Obama. Whereas Malcolm Turnbull's personal charm seems to have scored him an early invitation to visit Washington, D.C.
Even if apparently it was quite an unexpected one.
It seemed that way, yes.
But do you think in reality Malcolm Turnbull over the next year or 18 months, assuming he was re-elected, just has to go with the flow of what the Americans want from Australia?
Yes, I think for as long as America is in this situation, it would be very difficult for them to come to Australia and say, we want more from you. And so the risk, if you want to see it that way, for us to become more involved is if the Americans say, well, now we're changing our strategy and you, Australia, should come along with us. I do think there's some possibility for more of these incremental steps that, like we've seen with Obama's use of special forces. And the next step, which I've written about recently, Michelle, is this idea that our own forces might take the step of moving forward with their Iraqi soldiers that they're training into combat zones. In defence lingo, this is called advise, assist and accompany. The accompany part we haven't been doing up until now.
Could also be called mission creep, presumably.
Well, mission creep, but from a military point of view, it's the thing you need to do to actually get more useful fighting out of the Iraqi army. They'll have more confidence in the field if they actually have their trainers alongside them, pushing them towards the objective. And so there's a sort of a balance that has to be struck between a sort of a military assessment of what will work versus the additional risk that goes with putting your soldiers into a much more difficult situation.
Do you think this conflict is actually ever winnable?
Only if you start to think in sort of generation-long time frames. I mean, I think if you strip away the sort of day-to-day events, what's actually going on here is a far deeper, far more strategic problem to which there is no immediate solution. And really, the simplest way I think I can describe it is to say that, you know, a billion Sunnis are not prepared to put up with the type of government that they've had delivered onto them for the last few generations. And we may not like the ultimate answer that Sunnis come up with in terms of how they wish to be organised. It could be something that's perhaps not as bad as Islamic State, but you know, akin to the type of system which has been running in Saudi Arabia, which in many ways is aligned, but just not quite so extreme. So this sense of redrawing the maps of the Middle East to come up with a new dispensation for Sunnis, I think, is really the big driver of strategic forces in the region. And that's going to take a generation to fix.
And would we have been in a different situation if there hadn't been the invasion of Iraq in 2003?
I don't think so. I think the Arab Spring, which really started out of North Africa rather than the Fertile Crescent, was the area that started to bring about this revolt against the political systems that the Arab Middle Eastern countries inherited really from the end of the First World War. It's clear that the invasion of 2003 was a disaster primarily from the point of view of what it did to the American mindset and the American military. And we're living with the consequences of that now, with a president that's learned completely the opposite lesson and refusing to engage. And paying an even deeper price, which was the allowing the Syrian civil war to run on in the terrible way that it has. So no, I don't blame the 2003 invasion. I think we were always going to see ultimately the breakup of the sort of Sykes-Picot boundaries that were negotiated at the end of the First World War. And this is what's happening in the Middle East now. It's a complete redrawing of the map.
Have the events in Paris, do you think, increase the danger of a terrorist outbreak here?
Yes, I think they have. I think there's a risk of copycat attacks, which are prompted by the extent of the media coverage and a sort of ideological mindset which says now is the time for me to take my stand as a
These as would be as more lone wolf copycat actions, though, wouldn't they? Because obviously what happened in Paris took a lot of organisation.
Yes. Not so much lone wolves. I mean, it almost invariably turns out that there's a network there somewhere in the background. But it is individuals who do radicalise more or less by themselves and then are facilitated through social media and through contacts, real contacts in the world, to undertake some sort of attack. And I think there's a risk of that. More dangerously for the world, I think there's a risk also of a repeat of these complex multi-location attacks like the one we saw in Paris happening in a range of different European countries. That's less likely to happen in Australia. But, you know, we could see something like that in Indonesia where there have been numbers of foreign fighters return and a significant network of Islamist extremists already in Indonesia. So, you know, it may well be that the biggest threat to Australian interests is actually in the risks people will face in Indonesia rather than here in Australia.
Now, we've seen some signs of backlash against Australia's intake of the 12,000 Syrian refugees. For example, independent Jackie Lambie's had a few things to say. Do you think these complaints are serious, or are they just a few individual voices?
I don't think they should be taken too seriously, because the differences that we face in terms of managing our refugee intake compared to what the Europeans are facing are enormous. So, you know, we have the opportunity to select refugees and to vet them for security purposes at refugee camps outside Syria right now, which should lend a much higher degree of confidence. The problem that we saw in Europe was more a case of, you know, thousands of people coming through in such a volume and at such speed that no security checks were able to be made. And, you know, there was, even from the very early stages of this, concern within intelligence communities that essentially Islamic State sleepers would be being pushed through as part of this process. And that's been shown to be the case in Paris. Now, we just don't have that here in Australia. And so my sense is that, you know, we shouldn't just imagine that this is a level of risk that presents itself here.
Could we turn to the white paper? It's been delayed now until next year after several delays already this year. How much rewriting do you expect will happen under the new Prime Minister?
I don't think there'll be so much rewriting as it's a case of the PM and the Minister for Defence needing to get across the fine detail of the document. You know, the guts of a white paper is always the many, many decisions that are taken with regard to defence equipment purchases. And as I think through what that list looks like, I really struggle to see how a Turnbull government would do things much different from an Abbott government, or a Shorten government for that matter, in terms of the precise investment choices that are to be made. So where there may be some changes is around the language to do with international engagement and the sort of front end of the white paper. That might reflect, a sort of a more outward-looking worldview that I think Malcolm Turnbull will bring to the job as Prime Minister. But as for the fine detail of defence decision-making, I don't actually see too many changes.
Do you think he would have any different view on China, for example, to his predecessor?
Well, I think Mr. Turnbull's view is informed by, you know, a lot of the business he did there in the 1990s as a businessman, and he understands that part of the Chinese society. I think the thing that he'll be spending a fair amount of time thinking about and reading up on in his new role is to understand Chinese thinking from a statecraft, from an international security perspective, where he's not actually had perhaps as much to do with that side of government business as some others have. And my experience is that being Prime Minister tends to make the occupant a bit more conservative about international affairs than when they take the job. That certainly happened to Julia Gillard, for example. And that we may see a similar process with Malcolm Turnbull, because he knows he has to balance his understanding of business connections with China with now the national security implications of dealing with a China that is becoming more assertive and in some ways a more difficult country to deal with in the Asia Pacific.
Given the unpredictability of how China will develop over the next 30, 40, 50 years, are you surprised that Australia's willing to lease the port of Darwin to China? To a Chinese company?
Surprised and appalled, Michelle, is the only way I can put it. I think this was a deep strategic mistake at a number of levels. The first being that, this is our only large-scale port really between Broome and Cairns for Australia's use should we find ourselves involved in military contingencies up north. Secondly, the very length of the lease itself. So we are as now
99 years,
which means to say we're as far away from the end of the lease as we are looking back in the other direction from the landings at Gallipoli. It's a long period of time during which, I think it's impossible for anyone to say precisely how China will evolve, whether our interests will coincide or clash. And then, within the existing Chinese system, there's also a great deal of opacity around how business and the Communist Party and the People's Liberation Army operates. And basically, my view there is that, no one becomes successful in big business in China around ports and strategic logistics without having the deepest connections into the party and the military. And that this is something which, has to be looked at from a very careful perspective if we're now talking about the same group investing in Australia, in the port where we are actually conducting increasing military cooperation with the US Marines. And so I find the decision quite alarming, and the processes that allowed it to come to fruition, I think in some ways were flawed.
Well, the Defence Department, though, seems quite relaxed about it.
Well, they've made a decision, and I guess they're sticking with it, would appear to be the case, but there's a lot of folk who are less relaxed. I think the Americans are puzzled about how it was that they were not in any way engaged in a conversation about what this would mean for the Marine deployment. And I think there are quite a few people, not least in defence, who sort of look on this and find it just a strange decision from a national security point of view.
What was the process?
Well, it's somewhat unclear because on the one hand, the Northern Territory government says that a full submission was made to the Foreign Investment Review Board, but they also say that it wasn't actually necessary for that to happen. There seems to have been levels of consultation, I think at fairly junior levels, between different parts of the intelligence community and the officials establishment. It's not clear to me how much of this came up to government, and indeed if it went to the security side of government rather than the business development side of government. And I think that we're now seeing through the comments that Scott Morrison made a bit of an acknowledgement that, look, this was fairly rough, you know, in terms of decision-making processes. And there's a need to just sort of think it through. Have we got the Foreign Investment Review Board processes right? Especially given that, you know, we're going to go into a period where there's many, many, many more high-value potential Chinese purchases of Australian infrastructure coming into the country.
So this can be visited again, can it? It could be undone?
Well, I think there's always the trump card which the federal government can play around the defence power in the Constitution. But of course, that has to be offset now against the sort of reputational risk, I guess, of changing an approach from the perspective of other countries looking at foreign investment here in Australia. So this is a really difficult one. And probably the thing that needs to happen is just, you know, a much harder-edged look at how can we now manage the security implications around the port to make sure that that is entirely manageable and will also facilitate what is a growing Australian-American defence cooperation relationship operating out of the port. We're also going to have to spend some time talking to the Americans about it, because I think it's very clear from comments we've seen out of Washington that they're finding this disturbing and a sort of a mixed signal in contrast to what came out of the Osmond discussions in Boston, which happened on exactly the same day as Adam Giles, the Northern Territory Chief Minister, announced the deal, but with apparently no mention of this from our ministerial team to their American colleagues at the Boston meeting.
Just going back to the white paper, the government is committed to raising defence spending to 2% of GDP, I think, by 2024. some analysts say this is impossible on present lines. What do you think?
I don't think it's impossible at all, actually. I mean, we have pretty much bipartisan support for that level of spending. I think we've also seen an early signal from the Turnbull government about its attitude to deficits in its decision to relax the government's grip over public service wage increases. And so I think what we're going to see from the government will be a somewhat more relaxed approach to deficit budgeting.
Even so, you would have to spend a lot of money quickly. Is that not so?
To get to the 2% by 2023-24, well, you know, the beauty of defence equipment is that you can spend a lot of money very quickly, Michelle. And it so happens we have a lot of fairly expensive items that will come into the budget starting from next year, including the Joint Strike Fighter, which is, you know, been long in the planning but will actually begin to arrive in significant numbers. So defence will be able to spend it. I mean, what the department wants to have is a sort of a smooth process of increase up to that budget figure, whereas the Treasury and Finance here have tended to argue the case for nothing right up until the last, and then a massive jump as you get to the year where the commitment for the 2% comes in. That would be very difficult for any organisation to spend in that way. But there are a number of really expensive equipment items coming up, submarines, frigates, replacement vehicles for the Army, which are going to take massive investment. And so the money can certainly be spent.
Spending spree is on the way. Just finally, the government's onto its third defence minister since it came in. Is this rate of turnover a problem, do you think?
Yes, I think it is a problem, Michelle. It's no good when you have a situation where, you know, a minister, I think, takes at least 6 months to get across what is a really complicated portfolio. And it's difficult because if you change in that time frame, it gives the department an opportunity to go slow on policy areas that it might not like the sound of, in the hope that a new minister might be persuaded to do something differently. And I think it reduces a government's capacity to actually shape and drive the portfolio in more precise ways. You get a sort of a ticking over rather than creativity. So it's not good. And what I would hope is that with Maurice Payne coming into the job, she's a smart and capable individual. And what she needs is just long enough to get used to the portfolio. And then I think she could actually make some really good progress.
Peter Jennings, thanks very much for talking with us today. Thanks to my producer, Pat Hutchins. That's all from our podcast for this week, and we'll be back with you again soon with another interview. I'm Michelle Grattan. Goodbye for now.